This is KCBX, Central Coast Public Radio. You're listening to Issues and Ideas, the show where local voices tell the stories that keep the Central Coast connected. I'm David McAbee. On this week's show, I sit down with Dina Gillio Whitaker to talk about her new book, Who Gets to Be Indian? A deep look at how the media continues to shape and sometimes distort Indigenous identity in America. Then Brian Reynolds stops by Volumes of Pleasure in Los Osos for a chat with Carol Leslie about the magic of independent bookstores in the community they build. And finally, Mira Honeycutt returns with another edition of Wine Country, this time visiting Cambria's only winery, Par Collective, to learn how their coastal setting influences every pour. From identity to the power of the written word and the magic of local wines, it's all happening right here on Issues and Ideas.
Hello, my name is Dina Gillio Whitaker, and I am coming to you from San Diego on the campus at Cal State San Marcos, where I am a lecturer of American Indian Studies and the assistant director of the California Indian Culture and Sovereignty Center.
Dina, thank you so much for joining us here on Issues and Ideas. Before we dive deep into your new book, Who Gets to Be Indian, please tell me what led you to write this book. What inspired you?
Well, it's a long-term project, I guess you could say, for me to understand myself as a mixed blood Native person who is displaced from my tribal community of origin, which is the Colville Confederated Tribes in Washington State, which is where my mother was from. And so she left there and moved to Southern California in the 50s and met my father, who was 100% Sicilian American, first generation person. And so I grew up with a very ethnically mixed background and identity. And my mom's native side, the Indianness that I inherited from my mother was always sort of it was always minimalized in my family. And and as I grew up, I grew up with all the stereotypes, all the misnomers, and so it was really about my trying to understand what all that meant and who I was in all of that. And it's been a lifelong process. Then I as I tell the story in the book about my relationship with Sasheen Littlefeather, who is famous for rejecting an Oscar on behalf of Marlon Brando in 1973 for his role in The Godfather, and how she became famous, an icon in Indian country for that act, and convinced for a half a century, convinced everybody in America and the and around the world that she was a Native American woman. That's what, that was the force behind the significance of that act.
Just for our listeners, can you just tell us just who she was and why she was so meaningful to popular culture at the time?
She, Sasheen Littlefeather, was in 1973, she was working at a radio station in San Francisco. She had been claimed to have been at Alcatraz on the Alcatraz Island occupation a few years before, but she had been asked by Marlon Brando to, if he won the Oscar, that he sent her to stand in for him and deliver the speech that would reject the Oscar. And when she did that, she got up on stage and introduced herself as Sasheen Littlefeather. "I'm Apache," she says, knowing full well that there is absolutely no truth to the statement. Who she was, in fact, was somebody who was half white and half Mexican, raised in Salinas, and in a self-identified Mexican-American family that had absolutely no claims to indigeneity, no known knowledge of heritage to even Yaqui. She claimed Yaqui years later, but the family had no known connections to Yaqui heritage. So she just built a persona, a facade of somebody that was this person that rejected Marlon Brando's Oscar. And the story that followed that was she was also an actress, by the way. She was an aspiring actress that she was, and a model. That's how she started, as a model in Salinas. And she had a certain kind of look. It was adaptable, malleable. She could make herself appear American Indian. And she sought to exploit that because at the time it was trendy, it was cool, it was in style. So she adapted that. And but she said that the appearance at the Oscars blacklisted her. She said redlisted her. She said she was blacklisted and investigated by the FBI, and it was the FBI that was responsible for this blacklisting, and it ruined her career. That was the narrative. That is provably false. And in fact, her career saw an uptick after the Oscars incident. Her most significant film roles were after the Oscars incident. But she was a bad actress. I mean, she had no talent. That's really what it came down to. But she championed herself, or she advanced herself as a champion for Native American image rights, like for fair representation, and that's what her speech at the Oscars was about. But as I show in the book, she actually worked against that in the work that she did, and as a fraud, but also in some of the film roles she did. She actually advanced harmful stereotypes against Native women, and I show that in the book too.
A lot of these harmful stereotypes that still persist today, is that correct?
Oh yeah. They're improving now, but certainly at the time she was in those roles, all it did was perpetuate some of those stereotypes. And I knew her over a period of about 10 years, and through that period I came to understand her as a complete fraud. And so I had lots of evidence. And including a journal, a handwritten journal that she had left me in possession of before she died. And so I always knew that that was something that I was going to have to do something with as a researcher, as a journalist. And I did. I wasn't able to do that until after she passed away. And there's a reason for that too. And having to do with, it was never okay to question who she was while she was alive. But after she passed away, it came out that she was not who she said she was, and I was able to build on that.
Before we go any deeper into the book, I'd like to know, why wouldn't you be able to ask any questions about who she was while she was alive?
Because she was so accepted as such this hero, this cultural hero, that even though there were whispers, and people have known since the late 60s and early 70s, the Alcatraz days, people in the Bay Area community had suspicions, and but they kept it to themselves. Native people tend to be polite that way. They tend not to, at least they used to be, like, you tend not to call those kinds of things out. But it's especially hard when it's somebody who's a hero. And as I say in the book, there are so few heroes in Indian country, especially at that time, that there's a need to hold on to what you have. And so she became unassailable. And especially toward the end of her life, when I first encountered her in 2012, she was already surviving a breast cancer diagnosis. And so she lived with this extreme health condition for the last years of her life, and finally died of it. So it was, unseemly to attack somebody, or to at least challenge somebody's identity when they were dealing with this. She's elderly and she's dealing with this health condition. It was just unacceptable for various reasons. So So we kind of had to wait until she passed away to really reveal this knowledge.
What a heavy piece of information to sit on, especially as an indigenous person who kind of holds this truth to themselves. It's got to be pretty heavy. I mean, in these journals, was there any sense of remorse or regret or knowing what these actions would lead to?
Oh no. She wrote this journal. It wasn't more as so much of a journal. She called it a journal, but it wasn't so much of a journal as it was a series of writing exercises because she was in a writing group. And it was toward the end of her life. So she, for 4 or 5 years, she wrote these entries as a part of this a journaling sort of writing group. And what was curious about those entries, we're talking 200 pages of handwritten commentary. And every single one of the pages was written with her signature. She signed it and she wrote a copyright symbol on it. So that told me that she fully intended to publish this one day. And she actually, that my relationship with her actually sort of culminated with her asking me to ghostwrite, help her with a memoir with me as the ghostwriter, which I agreed to do. And we started that project. And then she suddenly backed out without an explanation. And so that was when I really started to question, like, what's going on here and who is this person really? And in the meantime, I still had this journal after she ghosted me in that was 2015. And she passed away in 2022. So I had this thing in my possession for years, knowing that someday I was going to do something with it, but not sure what. And so I scoured through those pages and analyzed what she had written. And it became apparent to me that she fully intended to publish this one way or another. And so she was telling in the stories and that she told in the entries that she made, it has a feel of performance, of maintaining a performance that she had already been doing for decades. So it was disingenuous in many ways, although in some ways it wasn't disingenuous. She wrote a lot about her own illness, her health conditions. She was profoundly mentally ill, and she knew it. She had diagnoses of a schizoaffective disorder with bipolar tendencies, something like that. And so she was, heavily managed with medication. And I had to I watched her one time have a, kind of a somewhat of an episode where she was having hallucinations and knowing that there wasn't what she thought she was seeing wasn't actually there. But yeah, she was profoundly mentally ill, and I think that had something to do with her ongoing fantasy about being an abused Native American child, which was completely fabricated.
So you're holding on to her writings, her journal, and she ends up passing in 2022. And is this what inspires you to write the book, Who Gets to Be Indian?
The way that it came to me was to use that story as a case study, as I call it in the book, a Pretendian Princess, the curious case of Sachin Littlefeather. It's just a perfect example of a life that was so clearly fraudulent, was a fraudulent depiction of nativeness. It was just a perfect study. And from that case, I use that throughout the book as the common thread to talk about some of the aspects that are really common in Native American ethnic fraud, and she embodied all of it. So one of the chapters that I wrote is a chapter, it's a chapter called Indians, Hippies, and Shamans, Oh My. The subtitle is, I'm turning to it because I can't remember, California and the Birth of Neo-Indianism. So I make the point in the book that California is a site of origin for pretendianism as we know it today. And in that story, in the chapter, I tell the story of how Native people have been, their identities have been co-opted for various purposes, including in the conservation world. And the example that I give is something that happened in San Luis Obispo with the creation of the Chumash Heritage Marine Sanctuary. And that the story of that is that it was started, the project was initiated by a guy named Fred Collins in 2015, who applied for this designation under NOAA, based on his claims to Chumash identity. His family had started a nonprofit called the Northern Chumash Tribal Council. So it was a pretense of a tribe, using that name Tribal Council. But long story short, it was demonstrated through legal action that Fred Collins had no demonstrable Chumash heritage. In fact, it was shown that he had none. And so he still advanced this name, Northern Chumash Tribal Council. They rallied a lot of support all the way up to the level of the White House and levels, every level in between, and they really hoodwinked people that they were a tribe. And as Chumash people, they were advancing this marine sanctuary. In the meantime, there is an actual Northern Chumash tribe. They are not federally recognized, but their name is Yauktitchu-Teechu-Yauktolini, the YTT Northern Chumash tribe that is based, I think, in San Luis Obispo, right in that region. And they have legitimate ties to the local missions and have records of who they are going all the way back to mission time. So they have that kind of documentation, whereas the other folks don't. But yet they advanced this mission. They raised a lot of money. They are still raising money. Fred Collins passed away. His daughter, Violet Sage Walker, has taken over. She's become sort of the media darling of that project. She, rumor had it, she was invited to the White House at some point, dined with the president, supposedly, and that would have been under Biden. So people were hoodwinked all the way up the line in order to get this project passed. Well, the YTT folks had tried for years and years to say they are not a legitimate tribe. They are posers, and we are the legitimate people with that heritage. Nobody would listen to them. Nobody, for the same reasons, nobody wanted to hear about Saucheen Littlefeather being a fraud. So now we've got the marine heritage. It's been taken over in its relationship with the actual Santa Ynez Band, which is the only federally recognized Chumash band. And so that's correct. I mean, they are the tribe of record. They are in, they have that government to government relationship with the US. But at this point, Violet Sage Walker is now trying to purchase a tract of land called the Dos Pueblos Ranch, which is outside of Goleta. It's a huge problem, especially for the YTT band. So it's really, this is an example about why the public, it's really important for them to know.
Is there anywhere that our listeners can go or to read more about this case so they can be educated? It just seems like a big mess of misinformation and uneducation in this topic.
I would direct people to YTT's website, ytt-northern-chumash-tribe.com. I would start there.
That's very important. And thank you for sharing that. I believe that's news to myself, and I'm sure it's news to a lot of our listeners out there as well. Thank you for being on our show today. Where can people find your book and find you?
The book can be found in places where books are sold. I think it's in probably pretty much any bookstore. You can get it directly from the publisher, which is Beacon Press. You can order it from their website. If you buy from Amazon, you can buy it there. Any place books are sold is where you'll find it.
Dina, thank you so much for joining us here on Issues and Ideas today, and we hope to hear from you soon.
All right. Thanks, David.
Hello, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Carol Leslie, owner of Volumes of Pleasure Bookstore in Los Osos. Welcome, Carol.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Yes, you know, it's so wonderful. I interviewed you years ago, and it's high time we did this again. You know, could you tell us a little bit about yourself and where you're from, and also how you came to open a bookstore?
Well, I'm an immigrant, like a lot of people. I came from Toronto. I was born and raised in Toronto, and my mother sent me to live with my aunt and uncle when I was a senior in high school, and I thought this was heaven because I hated the cold. I hated the dampness of Toronto, but I love the Canadian people. My grandfather was always annoyed that all of us ended up in California. And I said, if you'd had the foresight to move us to Vancouver, we might still be Canadians. Anyway, I graduated from high school here in California. And then I was 16 when I graduated from high school. And I got a scholarship to UCLA, but I got on the campus and I couldn't deal with it. There were too many people. So I went to Citrus Junior College in Glendora, and then I went to Cal Poly in Pomona because I wanted to go to San Luis because it was a charming place, but I had an aunt and uncle I could live with free, so that made the difference.
Nice.
Anyway, so I'm very glad to be located here again, and I think the reason I fell in love with reading is because I spent a month one summer with my aunt and uncle and my cousins, and my uncle read us Peter Pan, and he did it with putting on different voices and everything, and it just made pictures in my head, and I thought, oh my gosh, this is wonderful that this can happen. So that's when I fell in love with reading and just have been in love ever since.
You know, I was a psychology major at Berkeley, and enjoyed everything about what they call cognitive psychology, how we process information. And art in general is very nutritious for people, but there's two art forms that are stand above others because they stimulate it's something of my own invention. I call it the imagining nerve, and that would be books and old-time radio.
Yeah.
And the reason they stimulate your imaginary nerve is they're designed to engage the reader or the listener and what the characters look like or what the smell of the flowers or the coffee might be. And so as opposed to watching a great movie or looking at a painting, you're actually immersed in the experience. And I think it's not only fun, but it helps you grow intellectually and emotionally.
Yeah. And a good example of it is I have a sister that's 15 years younger. And you know, there's a lot of changes happen in 15 years. And she was living with me at the time, so she'd already graduated from high school. And we were driving back from Mother's, and I put on a station that tells old stories on the radio. And because she's totally a TV person. And after the story was done, she said, oh my goodness, Carol, this is great. I can make pictures in my head as he's telling the story. I said, that's right, Bev.
Yeah. One time there was a library conference down in the LA area, and we went to a recorded books company where they have voice actors reading novels and doing the voices. And it just, I can't tell you, it makes my hair stand on end even now. Well, you know, what happened in your young life or adult life that led you towards owning and operating a bookstore?
Well, the fact is, ever since I heard Peter Pan, I became an avid reader. And in fact, I was going through a difficult time, and I read when I was living with my grandmother, and I read a book every night just because I could escape from my life through these wonderful words that people painted pictures for me. And it was just great. And I thought to myself, I graduated from college, and I thought, well, I have a Bachelor of Science in liberal arts. What the heck do I do with it? So I thought, I was into health foods, so I made myself a health food store, and it was fairly successful. And, of course, I carried books in that store. And then I thought, when we moved to Laguna Beach, California, I thought, oh, let's do a bookstore here. So that's how it came about.
Had you visited bookstores as a younger person?
Oh, my gosh, yes. And the summer I spent with my cousin, we would get on our bicycles in Pomona, California, and we would ride to the public library, and we would each select out, I think you could only get six at a time. So he'd pick six, and I'd pick six. And then we'd bicycle home, and we read those books, and we traded books with each other, and then we bicycled back to the Pomona Library to get more. Mm-hmm. So that's my commitment to reading.
When, just out of curiosity, you know, historically there have been independent bookstores like Volumes of Pleasure, but also chain bookstores. What led you to start your own business? Did you think it would be a big success, or you wanted more control? How did that work?
The bookstore in Laguna was more of a narrow interest store. So then when we moved here to San Luis Obispo and lived in Los Osos 35 years ago, I looked around and thought, well, they don't need another bookstore here, because we had 14 independent bookstores when we moved to this county.
Wow.
And I thought, no, we don't need another bookstore. So I went to work for the county for a year and a half, and then this little bookstore in Los Osos became available. And I thought, my partner stopped in and said, oh my gosh, let us know when you're ready to sell. And the old owner said, we're ready now. So that's how we came across that. And that was 35 years ago.
And you're still in the same location.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we didn't change the name because, you know, we had a reputation to live up to,
right,
or recover from.
Yeah, that's true. You know, when you buy a business, an established business, you're really buying the clientele.
Yeah.
Or renting them anyway.
Yes.
And hopefully
right.
that they'll continue to come. Well, you know, I'll bet you people would like to know, what are some common questions you get about books or the book business? Maybe something that would surprise people. What are common questions or misconceptions?
The common questions are sometimes very humorous, because people would say, have you read all of these books? And of course, none of us have read all of them. We've read parts of them. And the other thing is the challenge in finding a book for somebody when they don't quite know the title. And a glaring example is the book, people would come in and say, it's a classic book, The Education of Little Tree. And the title they'd come up with is The Learning of Little Feet. And
wow.
So from that, we had to pick their brain more to find the right one. And we did. So the other one I think is a classic is, there's a book out a number of years ago by a therapist, and it's called Excess Baggage.
Uh-huh.
And it's about how all of us have baggage in life. And the person asked for it, leftover genes.
Leftover genes.
We got it. And now that we asked a little bit more questions, and we had to, and then we extrapolated its excess baggage.
Uh-huh. Now, would it be jeans, trousers, or your genetic material?
No, jeans, trousers.
Trousers,
yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. So it's fun, and we try to help people. And people come in and say, I read a book years ago. It had a blue cover on it, and it had the one word in the thing. And so they expected us to pop up with the book. So we would ask them questions. Do you remember the author? Do you remember anything else about it, the subject, you know? So we have our challenges.
Yeah, it's in library language, it's called a reference interview, where you kind of tease out what the person wants. And sometimes it isn't even that clear in their own mind what they're after. But if you ask them leading questions and so forth, you oftentimes get a different or a better picture of what they're after. And of course, in librarianship too, and I'm sure you do it in the bookstore, it's called reader's advisory.
Yep.
So I like books that take place in Elizabethan England
exactly.
and deal with pirates.
Yep, exactly.
And you can usually build something from there. I would like to remind everybody, I am Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we're joined by Carol Leslie, owner of Volumes of Pleasure Independent Bookstore in Los Osos. What do you think the importance to you and to the community of an independent bookstore is in a community?
I think the importance is, I mean, we had a bookstore in Southern California, and then we moved here, and we found that the taste of the people who lived in this area is very different from those in Southern California. So you're able to hone in on the people's specific area of interest, and it's changed. And they would ask us for, you know, the 10 best books of such and such when the newspapers were carrying books that are selling.
Yeah, bestsellers.
And it would always be different from that which Northern California or New York or thing. So we're able to hone in on the interests of the community.
You know, it's such a fascinating thing where it's almost like you're a restaurant serving up a menu of food, but you want your menu to be of interest to the local customers, don't you?
Yeah, that's
Have you noticed changes in the audience or changes in people's habits as it relates to your bookstore over time?
Yes, it depends on the cost of books. Like, for example, mass market paperbacks were like $7.99, and now they're $12.99, and hardbacks were approaching $20, and now they're $30. So people have been more cautious about what they spend, but we have some devoted customers who come in and they just go around the store and they come up to the counter with 6 books. And it's a good thing we have some devoted customers because they keep us in line. And I'm since my back injury, I've not been able to read because of my pinched nerve. So what I've taken up is audiobooks.
Right.
And I wanted to recommend people to read the book called Mark Twain by Ron Chernow because it is absolutely wonderful. I enjoyed every minute of it, and it was a very long book. It was 24 hours. So it was a real commitment. And it will not only give you flesh out Mark. I've always been a fan of Mark Twain. In fact, when young people come in the store and they ask what should we read, etc. There's a classics. I tell them, you read anything by Mark Twain, John Steinbeck, and Shakespeare, and you'll have the whole gamut of psychological confrontation. So I would really recommend that. And it's not only about him, but it's about the times in which he lived. And the other one is called The Pursuit of Happiness by Jeffrey Rosen. And it is fantastic because he goes into depth of the founding fathers and what kind of books they read. And they were incredibly literate. I mean, they read Seneca, they read Cicero, they read the English philosophers. It's incredible how brilliant. And I don't think that the modern politicians have read this.
You know, I'm a big fan of being bilingual and speaking Spanish, which has opened up so many doors. But Ben Franklin was fluent in French. I'm pretty sure Thomas Jefferson was fluent in French. They were very worldwise and cosmopolitan people.
They were.
200
yeah.
years ago.
Yeah. We tend to think of old fuddy-duddies, but they were brilliant. And how they put our Constitution together was incredible. What a gift they gave us.
Yes, that's very, very true. What do you see next in the upcoming times with your bookstore? Are you going to be retiring, or do you have an heir apparent in your your reign of books?
Well, everyone who works at the store is over 60, mm-hmm. so some of them are thinking about retiring. Others are so devoted to books that they're never going to retire. And I'm 83 and had this back injury, so I'm not in the store very much. And remember during COVID, we had to close our businesses and had them limited hours. And we have limited hours at our store, and it's worked out beautifully for us as employees because we're all old. So we all want to work. So we're just open 6 hours a day, and it's worked out beautifully. And I don't know, they are running the store at this point. I mean, I have incredible people who are just devoted to the bookstore, to Los Osos, and to me. And we, all of us, live in Los Osos, so we pretty much reflect the Los Osos.
The community.
Yeah.
Foggy and cold, huh?
Foggy and cold. Yeah, I was glad to see the sun when we drove in today.
We have Los Osos weather where we live, and it was kind of bleak and grim this morning. I do want to mention something that has been happening recently that relates to your bookstore that I'm super proud of. As president of the Monday Rotary Club, we reestablished our tradition of honoring our speakers by having them sign a book that we present. And so I go to your store and I buy the books. Aimed at young people because the books are intended to go to Pacific Beach High School Library.
Oh,
in fact, we're making a donation of a whole bunch of books tomorrow. So to me, that's kind of a complete loop where we support local business, we support local young people, we support the joy of reading. As we sort of get towards the end of our time, Carol, what do you think are some of the bigger picture issues about books and reading that you see that people need to pay attention to?
Well, I don't know. I just know that we have some customers who are so devoted to reading and to books that they do something that they couldn't do with the chain bookstores, and that they come to us and say, I want to donate so much money. Help me pick out the books to donate to the libraries. And it's been a wonderful thing.
Yes. Well, you know, here's a case in point. I am constantly on this show, Bookwaves, interviewing local authors. Sometimes I have plenty, some standing in line, if you will. They might have an event coming up, a book signing. But a lot of times I need candidates for this very show.
Yeah.
And so I've told your staff to please keep me in mind if they meet a local author or someone who's doing a local book. You know, in psychology, we go back to that topic a little bit. There's something called a sense of place.
Yeah.
And a person who has a strong sense of place is what we call self-efficacious. Probably most people wouldn't know that word, but to be self-efficacious or to have efficacy in your life.
Applicable.
It means you're knowledgeable about your surroundings. You know how to exploit them to your advantage, and you're resilient over time because you know history, you know local color and you know, even things that are peculiar and unique to a place. And so I think reading about local events, a recent guest I had on the show was Mike Miner of the Miner. He wrote a memoir of his family and how they came originally from I think it was South Dakota, and wound up here in town owning several successful hardware stores. And so to me, the more we read, the better. But also reading about things local is, I think, key.
And I confess I did not hear that segment, and I hope that we have his book in the bookstore because we really want to reflect what's going on locally. And being an independent bookstore, there's only two left in our whole county, and we all of us sell a lot of other things in order to keep the store going. Incense, candles, clothing, musical instruments. Anyway, we've figured out a way to make it work.
Right. Another shop I go to is in Grover Beach. Nan's Used Books. Nan Fowler and her granddaughter Cassie, who's the mayor of Grover Beach these days. But I think they have crystals and other things that they supplement their stock.
Sure.
And it's a used bookstore, not a new bookstore. And I think people need to know that when we say there's only two independent bookstores, that means, to me, the ones that sell new books as well as other kinds.
Yeah.
Because there's all various used bookstores around, and they have their place. But it's nice to go and call you guys up and order a book and get it in a few days' time.
And part of our reach out to the community is that we hire the Cal Poly Land Dance team every year, and we've been doing it. This is our 24th year of doing it, and it's like our little gift to the community. At first, we had maybe 100 people. Now we have upwards of 300, 400, 500, and people really enjoy it.
So what is this, and where does it happen?
It happens on a Saturday in the parking lot at the bookstore, because it's wide open then.
Sure.
On a Saturday afternoon, and people find areas to park, and they just attend it beautifully.
What time of year does it happen?
This one's coming up is February 17th.
Great.
So it varies because it's based on the lunar calendar, not the solar calendar.
The regular calendar.
Yeah.
All right. I would remind everybody, this has been Brian Reynolds for Bookwaves on KCBX Public Radio for the Central Coast. Today we are joined by Carol Leslie, owner of the independent bookstore Volumes of Pleasure in Los Osos. Thank you, Carol.
You're welcome, Brian. It's good to be with you.
I'm Mira Honeycutt, host of Wine Country. I'll bring you stories from the Central Coast wine region through my conversations with local vintners and winemakers. It's harvest time, and there's no better place to be than on the busy crush pad of a winery. So today, I'm on location in Cambria with vintner Raj Parr at his Parr Collective Winery. Raj is a noted Central Coast winemaker committed to natural winemaking and organic farming with a portfolio of multiple brands in his Parr Collective. Raj Parr, welcome to Wine Country.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
There's a lot of activity going on here today. Tell us what's going on.
Yeah, it's kind of wrapping up harvest. It's our last few days. So today we're picking the last of our whites from here at Phelan Farm. And then on Monday, we're going to pick all of the Syrah we have. Not much of it. We sell most of it and make a little bit ourselves.
So today, the last of the grape variety that's coming, what is that?
That was Sauvignon. So Sauvignon Vert and Sauvignon Jaune, two different kinds of Sauvignon.
What part of France does it come from?
It's from the Jura region. Yeah.
It's quite rare here. Are you the only one growing it?
There is a little bit of Sauvignon in the North Coast. There is a little bit in Ballard Canyon, which I had helped plant. And there is a little bit in Santa Barbara County, but not much. I mean, there's probably less than, 20 acres in the state.
Wow. So in this big bin, it was being weighed. How many pounds was it?
It was around half a ton.
And it was going where?
It was being pressed, and then from there it goes straight into a barrel, and it'll ferment, naturally ferment on its own, and it'll age in the same barrel, and it'll sit there for, year and a half or two, and then eventually we rack it and bottle it by hand, like all our wines.
So when it's fermenting, you use natural native yeast, you don't add anything to it?
Yeah, no, nothing is added in any of the wines, yeah.
That's part of your minimal approach winemaking, right?
Yeah.
Natural winemaking.
Yeah, it's we grow the grapes organically here, and then it goes into the barrel and ferments without anything, yeah.
So since you're in a cooler climate here in Cambria, when did the harvest begin for you?
We started with a little Pinot end of September, and then kind of slow trickle, and then really got going around the end of the first week of October into the second week. That was the busy week, and after that, it's been just a slow, we picked the grapes mostly ourselves, so we're slowly picking them as we go through the end of the season. And in the middle, this year was unusual because we've had two storms, one small half inch and one we got 2 inches of rain.
Right.
And so we had to kind of make decisions of what to pick before, what to pick after. And it's been an unusually cold year. The warmest day was 88. We didn't hit 90 even once. And we've had very few days, even above 80.
So talking about this cooler year, what's your comment on Harvest 2025?
Never seen anything like it. And I've only been here for 5 years, but it's definitely the coldest year. But sunny. It was less fog this year than the last couple of years. it was sunny, so, and it wasn't as bad during flowering. We had some late rains in the spring, kind of a gentle flowering, and a very cool, long, beautiful summer. Really high acidities, moderate alcohol, and really fresh and vibrant and really like, you know, crunchy wines.
Well, that's your signature in any case.
Yeah, I like that. Last year was slightly warmer, and then 22 was quite warm.
Yeah.
And 23 was quite wet. So this has been, of the 5 years, this has been the most kind of mild and gentle season. Yeah.
So we're sitting here at what was once called Stolo Vineyards. Tell us your connection with Stolo.
Yeah, so I was making the wine for the family in 21 and 22. And then in 23, I started renting the property and we converted the vineyards to regenerative farming. And we planted a new vineyard. We're going to replant one of the existing vineyards. So now all the vineyards here, which was called Stolo, and now it's part of Phelan Farm. Phelan Farm was the original vineyard I farmed on San Simeon Creek Road, and now these vineyards are also under the same Phelan Farm. We do bottle a little bit of wine under Stolo from the vineyards across the street, just to kind of keep the label continuing, so people recognize. Mm-hmm. So it used to be called Stolo, and now we call it the Park Collective Wines. And that is, it's a tasting room, and we have some events, hopefully more things coming next
year.
Well,
I've been to one of your events, and you're quite a DJ as well, being a great winemaker. So what's your total production? It's very small.
We make around 2,000-3,000 cases total from our own vineyards, because we sell a bunch of our grapes, and the yields have been low the last few years. And then we also buy grapes, and the purchased grapes label is under Bridge Wines. Bridge is my father's name, so we make some kind of Appalachian wine, slow coast Chardonnay, Pinot, and Rosé, and then mostly my own vineyard is all on the Phelan Farm.
So your portfolio contains quite a few different brands, so tell me all the names.
Yeah, the reason it's called Par Collective is, Par is my last name, but it's a collection of four different labels. It's Phelan Farm, which is the estate wine, Stolo, also a small amount of estate wines from the vineyards here, and then Bridge Wines, which is the Negos, the purchased grapes, mostly only from Slow Coast from now on. And then we have Scythian Wine Company, which is, we make some wines from the old vineyards, very old vineyards, over 100 years old, in the Cucamonga area. And I'm about to launch a new label next year, which is going to be the Italian varieties. We have vineyard in Santa Barbara County, so there'll be some Nebbiolo and Sangiovese.
We just saw some Nebbiolo percolating there.
Exactly, some Caricante and Nerello Mascalese and Caterato. Another set of obscure grapes.
Well, you're known for that. But you know what? You're making them trendy now, because a lot of different wine growers are looking for those varieties.
Yeah, it's fun. I try to make wines that I enjoy and that kind of thought-provoking and interesting and
So you were once known for Pinot Noirs, right? Talk about your brands in Santa Barbara County that you started with.
Yeah, so I'm no longer involved. I was with Sandy and Dome de la Cote, and I started that in 2009 and 10, and then my last vintage was 2021, and I'm no longer involved in those wines.
Both of those brands?
Yeah.
Dome de la Cote and Sandy.
Correct, yeah.
So why this pivoting from Pinot Noir to these obscure varieties?
We still make plenty of Pinot Noir and Chardonnay, but also other things.
But once you told me, there's a lot of Pinot being made. Is that true?
Yeah, 100%. Because, you know, if you make Pinot, it has to be with intention, in the right place, in the right way. Because there's a lot of, you know, mediocre, just uninteresting Pinot Noir made in the whole world. So we try to kind of focus and make small amounts of wines that are interesting and compelling and kind of, you know, give you a look into what really the place is, not just a Pinot Noir from anywhere.
If you're just joining us, this is Wine Country, and I'm Mira Honeycutt. Today, my guest is Raj Parr, vintner and proprietor of Parr Collective Vineyards and Winery in Cambria. Raj, talk about growing up in India in the bustling city of Kolkata.
Yeah, it was amazing. You know, far away from where we are right now in nature, it was, you know, millions of people, and it was an amazing experience to live in such a vibrant place with all the amazing, you know, cultural elements and the food elements and big city with so many people. It was incredible.
And how did the introduction to wine come about in that city?
Oh, wine was way later. When I was 20, I went to the UK and I spent time with my uncle, and that's when I first had wine. And then the following year, I moved to New York to the Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, and was studying to become a chef. And then while I was there, I kind of fell in love with wine and, you know, moved to San Francisco, worked with the great Larry Stone, and learned to be a sommelier. And that's how I was a sommelier for 18 years. And in the middle, I started making wine. I worked a harvest at Calera in Hollister and made a little bit of wine with Jim Clendenin, and then finally...
You worked with some big masters.
Yeah, no, you know, the old school, and they taught me well, so.
But when you say you went to UK, you had your first taste of wine, what was your reaction?
Well, I was 20 years old, I hadn't really never had wine before, and I was like, wow, this is like made from grapes, because, you know, as a kid, you eat grapes, and you don't think about, because, you know, the normal... Booze is a spirit, you dilute it with something and drink it.
Did you like it or not?
Yeah, I loved it. No. For the first sip I had, I was like, wow, this is so interesting. It was some kind of Bordeaux. I don't remember what it was. It was a Bordeaux. I'll not forget the...
That's always does it. That the Bordeaux gives people an epiphany. Oh, this is great wine. They don't know what it is, right?
Truly. No, it was kind of hilarious that, yeah, it was Cabernet was the first sip of wine I had.
And then you became a Pinot man.
No, I admire Cabernet. I mean, if you know, in my top 10 list of the greatest wines I've ever had, probably half will be Cabernet. Yeah, Bordeaux, old Bordeaux, nothing like it. Yeah.
Talk about your natural winemaking process and farming practices.
Yeah, I think the natural approach to wine is starts in the vineyard, because you know, there's not that much organic viticulture in California. It's, you know, around 4%, and so I wanted to kind of use a more holistic approach in the vineyard and embrace the regenerative farming and learn the holistic way of farming. So it started there. And then you transfer that in the cellar to try to grow perfect grapes. And when we make the wine in the cellar, we don't make any adjustments, and we don't change the wine if the wine is at 10.5% or 14.5%. That's what's going to be. If the wine is, of course, you know, it's also a business. So you have to kind of, but not to make the wine taste the same every year. It's not. You know, like 23 was a fragile year. The wines are much more fragile, much more delicate. And 24 was frost year, but low yields, concentrated. And that's the vintage gives you that. That's all the way it is. You know, of course, wine doesn't make itself. You have to still do things to it. You still have to press it or rack it or, you know, sometimes add sulfur to it during fermentation, sometimes at bottling. But it's not a recipe that we have to do this just because we're going to make end product. It's if something is going haywire and the VA is shooting up and you need to.
You have to answer to that, right?
Yeah. You have to add sulfur to kind of stop the wine from going the wrong direction. But you make correct wine, and you know, you don't, no fining, not filtration. If you buy grapes, you're buying from organic vineyards. So all these things have, you know, playing a part, of course. In the perfect situation, which happens a lot here, there's nothing added in the wine. But sometimes you have to kind of make a judgment call of, oh yeah, we're going to add small amount of sulfur, or we'll rack this, or we'll blend this. And sometimes you throw the wine away. Yeah, that happens.
Because what? You don't want to make too many adjustments?
Yeah,
Like you don't want to play around with it?
You know, you blend it in, or if it really goes haywire and doesn't work, you just dump it on the drain.
What a waste.
It happens.
Yeah. Talk about the organic practices. I remember visiting you at your other San Simeon farm one day, and you had animals, you had sheep, and you were feeding them something very special you said you had made at home. What was that?
No.
It was like a tofu.
No, we have sheep. A lot of things, but I don't like. I hate throwing trash. Even now, when I have any vegetables and trimmings and stuff, so we give the sheep and
that makes sense.
And the chickens. And when I make almond milk at home, and I'll take the almonds and I'll give the almond pulp to the chickens because. Why throw it down when they'll eat the almonds? So yeah, and we do a lot of holistic preparations and teas.
Like what?
So like we used I think in 2021-22 exclusively we sprayed only like some seaweed preparations and milk. Yeah, raw milk. I got raw milk from Cal Poly and from the Lompoc prison. And
spray of raw milk.
Yeah, just spray raw to combat powdery mildew.
Oh.
We've done oils. We've done other teas and compost teas, compost extracts, and different kind of. We played around with different treatments of
And what about the no-tilling practice? You follow that?
Yeah, we do. I won't say it's completely no-till because we've done a number of years of no-till to get. The organic matter up and to kind of build soil, but we do kind of one kind of disking a year just to terminate the cover crop. So I won't say it's no-till, it's just controlled till, just maybe once a year, because sometimes you do things just because someone said you have to do it, and then we kind of watch it and make a decision of if you need it or not need it. I think no decision should be made just because that's what somebody told you or that's what you read. You make a decision, we kind of take a deep breath and say, okay, let's try it this way, try it this way, and see what the results are. Because you can only do it once for 1 year, and the next year don't do it, third year do it, and you see what the results are.
Right.
And different places have different results. So I don't think that if someone says, I till 5 times a year, there's no right or wrong answer.
It just depends on
what the place is. If you're set up somewhere, like here we have a high water table so we don't have to irrigate, and we're also on clay soils, so it has good water holding capacity, and we haven't irrigated in 5 or 6 years now.
Well, you have a lot of moisture here in this cool climate.
There's a lot of vineyards that high density planting, and they have irrigation, and that's fine. But it's different.
I think it's all part of what I say, conscientious farming. And you make your judgment call, and each vineyard is different.
Yeah.
Each farming is different.
100%.
Yeah. But thank you so much for welcoming us to your winery today in Cambria.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
You are listening to Raj Parr, Mintner and proprietor of Parr Collective Vineyards and Winery in Cambria. For Issues and Ideas, I'm Meera Honeycutt, and this is Wine Country.
You've been listening to Issues and Ideas on KCBX, public radio for the Central Coast. Our theme music comes from Gary Eister, and a big thank you to all of our guests and contributors. I'm David McAvey. Join me every Monday from 1 to 2 for more stories, more voices, and more of what makes our community tick. And if you miss something or just want to hear it again, you'll find every conversation waiting for you at kcbx.org. And remember, the best stories are right here at home. Thanks for listening, and I'll see you next week. This is KCBX.